Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this is episode number 114, and we're going to talk about an American classic, Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Woohoo!
Yeah, and I hadn't read this before. So this is my first time, and I understand you've read it before.
This was my fourth time.
Your fourth time. I was, I don't know, I was going to say surprised, but I was surprised by some of the content.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin is a book that you hear about so often in life that it's almost like, well, you know what that is, even if you haven't read it, right?
Right.
But there were things in here that we'll talk about that I was surprised by that were in there. It was different than I expected and the same as I expected, both. But I liked it very much, and I thought it was extremely worthwhile. And thank you for picking it, because this is something I probably never would have read, but I think that I'm better off having read it.
Oh, good. I'm so glad.
Yeah,
well,
I really thought it was
I'm
good.
The same as you. The first time I read it, I was the same as you. Rose was reading it. She was starting to work her way through this list in a book called, I don't know, it's like the 100 books you should have read in college but didn't. She was in high school, but she started reading. And she kept saying, "Mom, you should read this book. It's so good." And then what she would do is tease me with some of the philosophical comments in the conversation. And I go, "What? It's saying that about the Bible? It's saying that about, I didn't know that." And so I finally read it and was so stunned by the series of amazing cliffhangers in here. And I was like, this is like the best soap opera ever written, with a wonderful moral message, something we can still use today, even though it was about slavery. And that, in fact, is what inspired me to go on and, after I read it, say, well, I wasn't reading it because I assumed it was a boring classic that I knew all about. What if I tried another? And so then I tried my first Dickens book, Tale of Two Cities. So that set me off on a path of a whole different kind of reading. So it was very, very influential to me. And then I read it for Forgotten Classics and wound up doing a lot of commentary around it, because it is a touchy book, especially if you don't know much about it. And so then learned more and loved it even more. And then I think probably this is my second favorite book right after The Lord of the Rings.
How about that? Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. And your reading is wonderful on Forgotten Classics. I listened to three chapters, which I had had a chance, you know, and it was just kind of scattered throughout, you know, because I wanted to hear it and listen to the commentary at the end. I wanted to listen to all of them, just the end of all of them. But your reading was terrific, and your comments were wonderful too. So,
thank you.
Yeah, I really highly recommend it. We'll definitely link to it.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, you bet. You bet. Now, you mentioned Dickens. Now, Dickens is a contemporary, right?
Mm-hmm. He actually really liked the book. He met Harriet Beecher Stowe and complimented her highly on it. And you know, it's one of those things that I did want to mention is, you brought up one thing, is we all think we know what this book is.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, because I had seen The King and I, and I saw their little play within the play that they did, and I was like, well, that's it right there.
Yeah.
I don't know what I was thinking, but anyway, but that's what every American thinks. And we're also taught that the book is not really that great literature. It's okay. It was a political book. And so when I was looking stuff up, what keeps being said again and again is the Europeans view this as a masterpiece. It's the Americans who keep putting it down.
Well, that's it. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. It was interesting in the Wikipedia post. It says that in the first year after it was published, 300,000 copies of the book were sold in the United States and 1 million copies in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting.
In this book I have, which this is a really great book, and I'll be sure there's a link to it also, it's called Uncle Tom's Cabin, Evil, Affliction, and Redemptive Love. It's from the Twain's TWAYNES Masterwork Series. And I've read a few of their books on Dickens also, which have been like a class, really wonderful. But this says, as of 1976, it had been translated into 58 languages from Afrikaans to Yiddish. Nearly 150 editions, many with numerous reprints, have appeared in English. It has gone through nearly 60 editions in French, over 80 in German, and nearly 60 in 21 languages of the people of the Soviet Union, which, of course, is not existent anymore. This book was written in 1991. And they said that among contemporary European writers, George Sand, George Eliot, Charlotte Bronte, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, Heinrich Heine, Charles Dickens, Ivan Turgenev, I'm probably butchering that, Victor Hugo, and Leo Tolstoy loved it.
Wow.
Sand and Eliot thought Stowe a writer of genius, and Tolstoy saw in Uncle Tom's Cabin an example of the highest art.
How about that?
Yeah, and I was just like, wow, George Eliot, really? Because Middlemarch is an amazing book. So, yeah.
Another one I have not read. But, yeah, reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, I felt like it was one of the great examples in literature of letting you feel what it's like to be another person that's not mm-hmm. you. You know, and she was able to do that through a number of characters.
Yeah.
But yeah, to feel what it is like to be the other, I think is one of the powers of fiction.
Yeah, I think a phrase I've seen describing it, which most people wouldn't think of, is psychologically complex. And I think when you look at all the characters that she introduces and some of the things they go through, I mean, at one point, Uncle Tom experiences a dark night of the soul, and you really understand why.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's at the perfect point where you go, of course he would feel that way. Who wouldn't? You know, they say that it's a combination of both sentimentalist work, which was, you know, of the time where you've got like the Little Eva thing. But they said most of those aren't nearly as realistic as this. And they said this is really mostly a work of realism. So anyway.
Sure. That's interesting because, you know, I would agree.
Yeah.
You know, I kept every time I returned to it, I was in there. You know, like some books are, you read it and the characters are very real. Mm-hmm. I felt that throughout this book.
Yeah, that's well. Yeah. And so, should I give a quick summary?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, so it starts off on a farm, and these people, I can't remember their name. Well, not the Harrises, but anyway,
the Shelbys.
Shelbys, thank you.
You're welcome.
They are nice. They're an example of living close to the North. They're in Kentucky, and they're nice slaveholders. You know, they treat their slaves well. And in fact, one subtle point that I didn't know until I read about it, at one point somebody's having to go down to Uncle Tom's cabin in the middle of the night, and the dog's like, I don't understand. No one's ever out at night. I'm confused. And they said that was kind of a subtle way for Harriet Beecher Stowe to say, no master is sneaking down to the slave cabins at night when his wife is asleep.
Mm.
Because she didn't shy away from pointing out this is the kind of thing that was going on.
Yeah.
And anyway, so they live a wonderful existence where you could really almost say, wow, life like this is pretty good. But the master, Mr. Shelby, has gotten himself into financial trouble, and so he has to sell slaves in order to keep things going. And so he sells Uncle Tom, who's super valuable because he's honest, fairly young and strong, upright, good worker, but it's not enough for the slaver. And so the thing with little Eliza's little boy is just like the worst example ever. She starts right in early on, Harriet Beecher Stowe does, with this little kid comes in, he's maybe 3 years old, and he's a pet around the house, essentially. I mean, you know, they treat him like he was a grandchild or something.
Mm-hmm.
They love his songs, they give him treats and things, and then the minute he's gone, the guy's like, oh, I could sell him for a lot. And he's like, well, I don't want to. Okay, but don't tell my wife.
Yeah, that was a heart-wrenching conversation. The first of many in this book, but yeah, you could tell. I mean, the guy was just, he picked like the exact wrong two, the exact toughest two there could be.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what Stowe does is she essentially, we've all heard of the famous sequence of Eliza jumping on the ice over the river. Well, Eliza is the little boy's mother, and she overhears what's going on. And so she's escaping with her child in the middle of the night, as who wouldn't, you know? And so she's set off to the north. So we watch her path as she goes after she's, you know, gotten far enough away to go on the ice on the river, and she's being smuggled on the Underground Railroad. We see her husband's story. He's got a difficult story also. They're both headed north. Uncle Tom is headed south. He's sold. And he's warned in time. He has a chance to run away. His wife, Aunt Chloe, says, I'll get your things together. You go with Eliza. And he says, no, I can't do that, because didn't you hear? Master would sell everybody. I'm so valuable, I can keep all of you here where you should be. So he starts right off sacrificing himself for everyone. And so as we watch him go down the river south, which is the worst place, no one wants to be sold south because they know those cotton plantations are awful. We see him encountering different masters and different people as fortune overtakes him, until he winds up with Simon Legree, who also we know from, if we've watched The King and I, is the worst Simon of Legree, and he is awful. And so on these journeys, what you get are these amazing stories that are heart-wrenching, but there's also funny stuff in there. It's like I said, it's like the best soap opera ever, with a very strong Christian underpinning, because Stowe was a daughter of preachers, or a daughter of a preacher, sister of preachers, wife of a preacher. She was very rooted in Christianity. And to her, Christianity is the answer to slavery.
Right. And that was one of the things that surprised me about the book.
Me too, when
was I first that, read it. Yeah, was that it was so Christian. And she would go, you know, you would have scenes with, you know, the other thing was the conversations about slavery itself. She didn't just show it to you, you know, show you the horror of it. But then the slave owners would have conversations, and they would always, you know, often have doubts about what they were doing, and, you know, are they doing things correctly or whatever. But anyway, you'd have people in a parlor, and they would talk for a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And that surprised me too. Because it, you know, those chapters weren't dry. They were very interesting. But I really enjoyed, so it was like there was a lot of philosophy in it and a lot of Christianity in it. You know, the Christianity is philosophy too, but
right,
there was a lot of moral philosophy.
Well, and she did interesting things with
like
it.
Dialogues is what I meant.
Yeah. And she would do things that were funny, like one of the characters, St. Clair. He's a slaveholder who lives in New Orleans, but he's well aware that this is a bad system.
Yeah.
He just essentially, what you find out is he feels like he's trapped and he can't really change anything. So he does the best he can in his own little situation. But his wife, who's like the worst example of everything, Marie, she will say, oh, we enjoy church so much. The preacher told us all about how slavery's okay according to these things in the Bible. And he'd go, oh, the Bible, is it? And he would be flippantly sarcastic, and you'd just be laughing because he was so funny, but he was so right.
Yeah.
So she used all kinds of techniques to get this across. And so what happens is you see where Eliza and George, her husband, end up. You see where Uncle Tom ends up, and, you know, you don't want to say a lot more at this point, I guess, but...
Well, it's a very old book.
So, yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. And one thing that you said to me a few days ago that was very interesting is that she was accused of, you know, well, this stuff doesn't really happen. This is extra dramatic. And, you know, look what you've done. You know, you're whipping everybody up. And then what did you have to say about that?
Oh, well, she was accused of that from the beginning. And actually, you know, she got so much hate mail. She even got a box that had a finger or an ear?
Oh, wow.
A black finger or an ear in it.
Wow.
I mean, that's how much people were. I mean, a lot of people embraced it.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody who was pro-slavery did not like it, of course. And so what she did is she wrote a second book called A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, where she put all the documentation of everything she included in the book, because everything she put in there was factual. She even wrote to, I think it was Frederick Douglass, you know, the famous slave who mm-hmm. was real educated, and he was a freedman then, but he would go around and do talks and things. She even wrote to him asking him about plantation life before she did the Simon Legree part. She wanted to get everything accurate. So when Eliza jumped across the river, that actually happened. It was in the newspaper. and she had that was one of the things that kind of made her start thinking about it. So,
yeah, I think that's fascinating. So her characters are like conglomerations or.
Right.
There's a word for that that I don't, it's not coming to my head, where you have a character that is representing a bunch of different things at once.
Right.
Or you're taking a bunch of real events and putting it into one character's life rather than, you know, every character has its own event or something.
Yeah,
like
because
that.
You have to use it for the service of the story too.
Exactly.
But here, this is the thing I thought was interesting is the early responses from abolitionists and African Americans, and it says the most enthusiastic was Frederick Douglass, a leading black abolitionist. He called Uncle Tom's Cabin the master book of the 19th century and consistently defended Stowe against attacks, expressing his own, quote, reverence for her genius. And then this is a quote: "She who had walked with lighted candle through the darkest and most obscure corners of the slave's soul and had unfolded the secrets of the slave's lacerated heart could not be a stranger to us."
Wow.
And then there was another ex-slave who was talking about the auction block, and she describing it. And she said, "Happily, this task is now unnecessary. Mrs. Stowe has thrown sufficient light upon that horrible and inhuman agency of slavery." So she didn't have to describe it anymore. And then one of the things that she was accused of a lot was that Uncle Tom was, and in fact, that's still an accusation now, is that he was too meek and mild. And, you know, that's where the phrase "an Uncle Tom" comes from, is the plays they would do of this book, where he would just, "Oh, yes, massa, yes, massa." And actually, they talked to ex-slaves right after the Civil War and talked to them about, read the book to them,
mm-hmm.
and then said, "What do you think of Uncle Tom?" And they all went, "Oh, he's not talking like a slave." And they went, "Aha." And they said, "Oh no, he was way too forceful. No slave
wow.
would have mm-hmm. dared speak up the way he did. He would express his opinion. He would tell his master, 'I'm worried you're not living the right way.'" They're mm-hmm. like, "Even a nice one you wouldn't do that with." And they're like, the way he'd talk back to Simon Legree, you know, even just refusing to answer was considered too risky. And so you don't think of him as being a forceful character, but within that person, she made him speak up for, you know, everybody.
Wow, that's something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was impressed by that.
Yeah, I'm trying to look in this Wikipedia entry as well. It said something about I can't find it. Something about it being, it's like in recent years, you know, or recently, you know, it in recent years the negative associations with Uncle Tom's Cabin have to an extent overshadowed the historical impact of the book as a vital anti-slavery tool. Do you know what the negative associations that it means? Well, what does that mean? In recent years, the negative associations with Uncle Tom's Cabin have to an extent overshadowed the historical impact of the book as a vital anti-slavery tool.
I think I'd have to read more of what they were talking
about.
Yeah,
that's all. That's the whole sentence that's there. Just saying... you know, I thought maybe, you know, there's a repeated use of the N-word in the book. And
well, and but that's realistic.
It is realistic. And the people that are saying it, you know, are characters who you would expect to be saying it. It's not like the author, you know, who's saying that in her paragraphs or whatever. I was just curious if you knew, you know, what does it mean, the negative associations? Why, you know, you said it was a touchy book when you read it.
Well, it's touchy because, you know, the word nigger is used repeatedly. Mm-hmm. It's which was hard for me to say just now, and it was hard for me every time I read the book out loud. And it's also touchy because, I mean, think about little Eva and Uncle Tom.
Mm-hmm.
So you have there, she's the perfect little white angel, or even Topsy.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. People.
So you
got to
kind of have like stereotypical, you know, like Topsy, I guess, is, you know.
Yeah, because poor Topsy, look at her life. She's the ignorant child. And then you have, you know, little Eva, who's just kind of naturally angelic and wonderful and all this. And so people would not like the comparison, but, oh, the black kid's bad. Or, you know, the Uncle Tom thing of he just scrapes and does whatever the white master wants.
And then I guess maybe you have, you know, well, Harriet Beecher Stowe being a white person saying, well, your solution is our solution. Maybe, I don't know. Just trying to think.
Yeah, the Liberia thing, which was her solution, her idea about slavery. Before she died, she said, you know, that was a bad idea. At the time, it was put forward as this is here. You are a free people. You can have your own country and run it. And and people were going, but I don't want to leave. This is my country. And so later she kind of rethought it, but the book had been written. I think there's an afterword in I think I have the Norton Critical Edition, one of my two or three copies of the book. And she had an essay there, you know, something she wrote that they put in the end where she went, oh, that wasn't the best idea.
Hmm.
So people pick on it for a lot of different reasons. And I think the best defense I ever saw was from Tom Stoppy. Is that his name? The science or Shippy,
okay.
The science fiction guy who took over from Tolkien, you know, the word guy at Oxford.
Okay. I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. He did a class, and I mean, one of those, great teaching courses that I listened to from Audible about heroes in literature. And one of them was Uncle Tom's Cabin. He talked about it. And he talked about Harriet Beecher Stowe, and he goes, yeah, she's criticized because she wasn't putting forward, you know, African-Americans the right way. She wasn't maybe thinking about their dignity the way she should have. She wasn't doing this or that. And he goes, that wasn't her point. What she wanted to do with that book is make white Americans ashamed of slavery. He goes, she wouldn't have cared about all that other stuff because that was not even an issue then. She did what she wanted to do. And I was like, yeah. And the other thing is, if you stop and really read the book, and this was the thing that really has gotten me every time I've read it, there's been a different part where I've been surprised by how much dignity she gave everybody she could in the book.
Yeah, I felt like, you know, Uncle Tom had a lot of dignity. And
well, and she was very sympathetic she was really fair even to people like, think of Tom Loker, that really brutish slaver. She gave him an old mother he cared about. And he was, she basically had him reform so that he was helping them get away, you know, Eliza and George get away by giving them advice. And who's the other guy at the beginning of the book who he doesn't reform, but the slave trader. Oh, shoot. Haley. He is never redeemed, but at one point, because she'll stop the book and she'll kind of just stop and start talking to the audience and go, and you might think this, but mothers, what about your children, you know? And so in this case, she was talking about him because he was kind of funny in a way, because he was always like, we don't need any trouble. And he would do everything to try and keep the crying from being too much of the slaves he was buying or whatever. But the funny thing to me was he really planned to sell up and then convert and become religious. So he knew what he was doing was wrong. But he was like, I'm not ready yet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's adding everything up, and we've seen him being heartless. And he goes, and you might think he's the worst example of Christianity. And she says, But you, sir, and you, ma'am, have you helped him? Who is it who made him profitable doing this? It's your laws, Northerners. It's the way you say, oh, well, it's nothing to do with me. Well, he is to do with you, and he's on you, too. The way he lives is your fault. And so she stops and looks at every angle. And I love that, that you're never allowed to just start feeling really supercilious, mm-hmm. maybe over Simon Legree.
Right, right.
But think about even, is it Quimbo and Sambo at the end? Who kill, they're the ones who at Simon Legree's orders, they whip Uncle Tom so much that he dies.
Yeah.
But he forgives them. His example is such that they ask him for his forgiveness and he forgives them. And so they're redeemed that way. They're the two thieves on the cross, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So even they, with their, you know, brutish ways that they've been lured into or taught by Simon Legree, have a chance for redemption.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Yeah, she really, you know, I liked that aspect of the book. There were two characters that were saintly, right? Eva, mm-hmm. like you were talking about, which was a white girl, and Uncle Tom.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, everybody else, well, Simon Legree would be the opposite, right?
He was pretty devilish.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he and maybe the slave trader who bought Uncle Tom in the first place.
Yeah, Haley.
Yeah, was that Haley? Okay, that's the same guy you were talking about earlier.
I thought that was Haley.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was rough.
Yeah.
He was like, "Yeah, we need to take this kid in the middle of the night so that we don't have any screaming and stuff, right?"
Oh, well, my gosh, think about what he did to that poor young mother on the boat.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that incident on the boat was horrible. I mean, she fell asleep with her boy next to her, and then when she woke up, the boy was gone. Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. Yeah,
he timed it so that the guy he sold him to, and it was just like an 11-month-old baby or something. I mean, and this poor woman, and these are the examples where people are like, oh, this couldn't have happened. Oh, yes, it could. Where the woman gets on the boat, she has a trunk, she has her little boy, and as soon as the boat takes off, Haley goes up to her and says, okay, your master didn't want to do this, so I will. You've been sold to me. And she says, no, no. He said I was going downriver to be with my old man, which is what they would call their husband, who's working in a tavern, and I was going to work in the tavern also. Because you could hire out your slaves to people and earn money from them if you didn't need them to work for you directly. And so that was common also in this book. And he's like, no, here you go. And so somebody had to read it to her. So a passerby had to read it to her. And so she's freaked out because now she's not going to see her husband anymore. And because everybody was always saying stuff like, well, you can get another husband wherever you go. And she's like, stop it. Just stop it.
Yeah.
And they kept saying they don't feel it the way we do. And so I think that's part of why Stowe was doing this, is because they kept saying they don't feel it the way we do. They're just like animals. They don't mind. And so she was hoping to see her husband. Was that it? When somebody came by to look at the little boy. She was looking and they'd pulled into port or wherever, and somebody comes by and says, hey, that's a fine looking little chap. Oh, yeah, I can sell him to you, but you're going to have to wait till we come into port and she's asleep. And then, yeah, he sneaks off with them.
Man.
And then when she finds him and she's freaking out, he's like, well, you'll get another husband. You'll have another child. She's just like, just don't, please, just don't talk to me right now. Stop it.
Yeah. Intense.
And then she kills herself.
Yeah.
Throws herself in the river.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. And, you know, she makes her point so well. And then, like I said, she starts to, you know, talk about it through her characters.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I think this is St. Clair. My view of Christianity is such, he added, that I think no man can consistently profess it without throwing the whole weight of his being against this monstrous system of injustice that lies at the foundation of all our society. and if need be, sacrificing himself in the battle. That is, I mean that I could not be a Christian otherwise, though I have certainly had intercourse with great many enlightened and Christian people who did no such thing. And I confess that the apathy of religious people on this subject, their want of perception of wrongs that filled me with horror, have engendered in me more skepticism than any other thing.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, famous quote by Gandhi, you know, I like Christ, but I'm not sure I like Christians.
Yeah.
That was a paraphrase, but something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's how important our example is when, even when we don't know anybody's watching.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's just so well put in a little paragraph. And mm-hmm. that stuff is throughout here. You know, and she would talk about philosophy. You know, so she's coming at it. It's like she just wanted to, every possible thing that she could think of that would mm-hmm. be an argument for this, mm-hmm. you know, she tried to refute in a conversation. You know, like a philosophical dialogue.
Yeah, well, and when you think about it, think about something like the pro-life issue. Mm-hmm. So we all know the way everybody argues against it. So if we were writing a book like this, she knew the way everybody would argue against it too. So she was putting in everything to show the fallacy of those beliefs.
Right, right.
The lack of a foundation. I was reading, because one of the criticisms that's made, especially in this country, is that the book is, you know, written in such a way that it's not very sophisticated. And what this book I have, The Evil Affliction and Redemptive Love, said is she was actually highly trained in rhetoric and logic and all kinds of literature, and she'd written essays from the time she was 10 about stuff, but she deliberately used an informal, unpolished style to make the book accessible and persuasive to as many common, regular readers as she could.
Wow.
Which is why it still resonates with, you know, me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to read something that's real specific, like, you know, rhetoric.
Uh-huh.
But this is such a great story.
Yeah, it is.
Not read it.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, you're talking about how she knew that stuff. There was a character, Dinah, and I'm trying to remember her exact situation. It says
the cook?
Yeah, Dinah was a character in her own way, and it would
St. Clair's cook, yeah.
Yeah. So Stowe says, like a certain class of modern philosophers, Dinah perfectly scorned logic and reason in every shape and always took refuge in intuitive certainty. And here she was perfectly impregnable. No possible amount of talent or authority or explanation could ever make her believe that any other way was better than her own, or that the course she had pursued in the smallest matter could be in the least mollified.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know that. But it's interesting, you know, yeah. That's like a dig at, you know, at a certain, you know, philosophical yeah. set, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so yeah. She was like, yeah.
Well, and you see, it's funny how many things she can do with one thing like that, because, you know, you've got Dinah, who is, you know, her kitchen is, it's hilarious the way she
that
keeps
was
the kitchen.
Funny, funny stuff.
It is. Yep. It's the kitchen is hilarious. And one thing this book was pointing out is that the different types of homes, and this was a style that people would have recognized from the writing of the time that I wasn't aware of really, but like your home often reflected, you know, not only the kind of family you were, but your moral sense. So your outer environment represents your internal state. So you think about Simon Legree's filthy plantation, and that's like him. Shelby, yeah. The Shelby's farm is nice and tidy. And then so you've got St. Clair's kitchen. The kitchen is the heart of the house, right?
Right.
And it's just scattered everywhere.
Mm-hmm. But she knew where everything was.
Right.
Yeah, the cook knew where everything was.
Yeah.
She had her own system.
Yeah, but and then she also uses her to show things like the internal problems that the slaves had, like the quadroons, were lording it over Dinah, who was a full black African-looking lady, they would say.
Yeah, so there was like that a hierarchy within the slaves.
Yeah.
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 Wow.
Now, I liked Dinah, but I have to say I have several favorite characters, but I have to say my favorite pairing, because, you know, she does what Dickens does, that there's always contrasts and pairings and couples that you to show you what's going on. But I just love Miss Ophelia and Topsy. And putting them together had to be inspired, don't you think?
Yes. So Topsy was given to her by St. Clair, who was like, okay, put your philosophy to work. You think you can teach anybody anything? Here you go.
Miss Ophelia's from New England. She's his aunt from New England. She's come down to help. Mm-hmm. And she's one of these people, and we see it all the time, and maybe we do it ourselves. She talks a good game as a Christian. I don't know how you can have slaves and this and that. It's wrong. They're people just like us. But she cannot bring herself to touch one of them. And when she sees Eva hugging everybody, when she comes back, she goes, I don't know how you could let your children do that, you know?
Yep.
And so St. Clair, in his devilry, says, here, I'm going to give you this article, which is ironic, how the way they would talk about, you know, the people. Mm-hmm. And let's see what you can do with all your stuff. You say you know how to teach her.
Yep.
And poor Topsy had no upbringing. She had been one of these who was taken from her mother when she was a baby. So she was raised with a bunch of other little children by some old slave woman who they called their aunt. When she was old enough, she was sold and then owned by these brutish people, it sounds like, in a restaurant who, you know, St. Clair said he bought her because he got tired of hearing her scream so much when she came by, and her back was just a mass of scars.
Yeah, yeah.
But so what she'd learned is, never let him get to you.
Right.
So Miss Ophelia doesn't have any way to control her.
Yeah, and she would talk back. She would do.
She would steal.
She was rough. Yeah, she would. She was, especially for Ophelia. It was difficult.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was really interesting stuff.
And it could really be funny.
Yeah. And then Topsy and Eva.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was interesting, too. Eva was like, you know, you should be nice. Yeah.
Well, Eva was the first person who'd ever told Topsy that she loved her.
That's right.
She'd never heard anyone say that. And she was like, what, 8 years old, 9 years old, something like that. Mm. So, and she also, this I thought was so fascinating. She also said that she knew she couldn't go to heaven or unless she was skinned so she was white. Because since she was black, she was bad. She knew that from the way she, you know, kind of internalized everything she'd ever heard.
Yep.
And that just broke my heart.
Oh, me too. Yep. I do remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Eva set her straight, though.
Well, but it took Eva dying for Miss Ophelia and Topsy to both open up. Essentially, Miss Ophelia was like, I'll love you. Because Topsy's like, now there's no one to love me. And Miss Ophelia went, I'll love you. I love you. I've been wrong, but I can change. And I think she gave her a hug right then.
Yeah.
I can't remember. But soon after, put her arm around her or whatever.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, it's very powerful. And then, so Uncle Tom, you know, he gets sold in an early part of the book, and he was a slave, but in as good a situation as he could be in, but he was still a slave.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was sold, taken away from his wife, and sold to someone else who ended up treating him pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So again, he was a slave, you know, but he's in this situation. And then I thought this was brilliant how Harriet Beecher Stowe did this. So he was, you know, Eva's friend, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, even though he was of service to the family, you know, as a slave, there was a relationship between him and Eva, who was a young white girl. You know, there was a lot of talk between them, right?
Yeah.
And then when she passed away, she said, Dad, please let Tom go, right? Please set him free. And then St. Clair died. And I thought, as soon as that happened, I was like, oh no. You know, it was just like, you know, hey, this happens.
You know? Every time I read the book, it upsets me.
It is. It was very upsetting. And so St. Clair dies. He gets in this fight. And he ends up dying. And then that is when Tom is sold again. Because the, you know.
Because the wife, Marie, right. is terrible.
Exactly. Exactly. So she wants the money and she sells him. And that's when he ends up with Simon Legree. And now you are in a dark place, right? Yeah. I mean, not that you haven't been, you know, these people are slaves. It's not like it's ever not dark, you know, because they're never really free.
Right.
But the, I remember I marked this place. Let's see. It's at the end of chapter 34 where Cassie is talking about Christ. And she says, I used to see the picture of him over the altar when I was a girl, said Cassie, her dark eyes fixing themselves in an expression of mournful reverie. But he isn't here. There's nothing here but sin and long, long, long despair. And Tom looked as if he would speak again, but she cut him short with a decided gesture. Don't talk, my poor fellow. Try to sleep if you can. And placing water in his reach and making whatever little arrangements for his comfort she could, Cassie left the shed. So Uncle Tom at that point had been whipped horribly.
Yeah, horribly beaten.
Yeah. Because he wouldn't whip somebody else. It was like Legree thought, you know, this guy would be a good, I forgot what they call him, a group leader or whatever, but he's got to be able to whip him into shape. And he said, hey, you, go whip those two. And he wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he got beat up himself. And then, you know, that's really interesting. You know, under extreme duress, you know, he just wasn't going to give an inch, and all the way to the very end.
Well, and that was one of those things as people went, you know, the real slaves went, that's totally unslave-like. Of course you would, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he was going to do what was right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And it's after that, isn't it, that he goes into his dark night of the soul?
Yeah, there's a...
Cassie says he's not here, and then Tom, like, he is just, he's depressed. I mean, horribly depressed and cast down and can't connect with God at all, and just...
Yeah. Yeah, and there were a couple of places that were, you know, really, you know, dark places as far as, you know, Christian philosophy goes. So I marked, see, I don't have a page number on here, but this is Miss Ophelia and St. Clair and Topsy and Eva in a room together. And I'm trying to see who said this. Oh, St. Clair said it. So he says, well, I'd like to just ask one question, said St. Clair. Well, what is it, says Miss Ophelia. Why, if your gospel is not strong enough to save one heathen child that you can have at home here all to yourself, what's the use of sending one or two poor missionaries off with it among the thousands of just such? I suppose this child is about a fair sample of what thousands of your heathen are. And then Miss Ophelia did not make an immediate answer. So then that's... Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, because she's really poking at people. Because one of the things he says right around then, or a little earlier maybe, is, oh, I know your sort. You like to talk about it, and you like to give your money to some missionaries and send them off to do it, but you don't have to do anything yourself.
Exactly.
You know, and it's funny because I was thinking about him. I was just finding a spot later.
Yeah, and I've got this, the dark soul that you're talking about.
Oh,
on my book, it's in page 384, which is chapter 38, near the beginning. It is strange that the religious peace and trust which had upborne him hitherto should give way to tossings of soul and despondent darkness. The gloomiest problem of this mysterious life was constantly before his eyes. Souls crushed and ruined, evil triumphant, and God silent. It was weeks and months that Tom wrestled in his own soul, in darkness and sorrow. He thought of Miss Ophelia's letter to his Kentucky friends and would pray earnestly that God would send him deliverance. And then he would watch, day after day, in the vague hope of seeing somebody sent to redeem him. And when nobody came, he would crush back to his soul bitter thoughts that it was vain to serve God, that God had forgotten him. He sometimes saw Cassie, and sometimes, when summoned to the house, caught a glimpse of the dejected form of Emmeline, but held very little communion with either. In fact, there was no time for him to commune with anybody. And slightly after that, Legree shows up when he's in the room one evening, and Legree says, "Well, old boy, you find your religion don't work."
Yeah.
I thought I should get that through your wool at least. The cruel taint was more than hunger and cold and nakedness. Tom was silent. "You were a fool," said Legree, "for I meant to do well by you," and then he goes on from there. Yeah. But he wakes up Tom's,
because I had just been looking for that part too, and the thing is that it doesn't matter what Tom's feeling, he knows what's really true, and so he's like, "No, the Lord forbid, you know, I'll hold on. The Lord may help me or not help, but I'll hold on to him and believe in him to the last." And Legree's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna break you, just, you know," and he leaves. And it says, "When a heavy weight presses the soul to the lowest level at which endurance is possible, there is an instant and desperate effort of every physical and moral nerve to throw off the weight, and hence the heaviest anguish often precedes a return tide of joy and courage." So was it now with Tom. The atheistic taunts of his cruel master sank his before dejected soul to the lowest ebb, and through the hand, and though the hand of faith, still held to the eternal rock, it was with a numb, despairing grasp. Tom sat like one stunned at the fire. Suddenly, everything around him seemed to fade, and a vision rose before him of one crowned with thorns, buffeted and bleeding. Tom gazed in awe and wonder at the majestic patience of the face. The deep, pathetic eyes thrilled him to his inmost heart. His soul woke, as with floods of emotion he stretched out his hands and fell upon his knees. When gradually the vision changed, the sharp thorns became rays of glory, and in splendor inconceivable, he saw that same face bending compassionately toward him, and a voice said, "He that overcometh shall sit down with me on my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father on his throne." And then when Tom comes back to himself, he's been lying by the fire for who knows how long. He's wet with dew. But that's the only place in the book where there's a religious incoming from the mysterious, spiritual world.
Right.
But you have to have that to understand what Tom does later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because now he's got power. You know,
yeah.
He's no longer afraid and no longer doubts.
Yeah, and even when it hurts, everything else, he's basically like, I have this to hold on to. I know what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really powerful.
It was very powerful. Yeah, and then what happens at the end, which we touched on with Sambo and
Quimbo,
you know, he gets wickedly beaten by these two at the command of Legree, and he just forgives them.
Well, and actually, as soon as Legree leaves, they ask him for forgiveness because they are so impressed by how he acted during that time. When he was being beaten and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that chapter is called The Martyr. So,
right. <yeah. laughs> Tough stuff.
Yeah. And in fact, while he's lying there and he's, you know, dying, and Legree's taunting him, and he's like, "I would give my blood if it would save your soul." I mean, he's saying that for Legree.
Hmm.
And that's our example, too,
however much
we've been hurt. You know, he says, "Master, if you was sick or in trouble or dying and I could save you, I'd give you my heart's blood. And if taking every drop of blood in this poor old body would save your precious soul, I'd give him freely as the Lord gave his for me. Oh, Master, Don't bring this great sin on your soul. It will hurt you more than 'twill me. Do the worst you can. My troubles will soon be over. But if ye don't repent, yours won't never end.
Yeah, and that harkens. Yeah. I was just going to say that harkens back to another time in the book earlier on when he tells St. Clair that he's not living right. And he fears for his soul. And St. Clair does chuckle. You know, he's like, you know what? I won't do that anymore. You know, and that was kind of him. But interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he tells the worst possible man what you just read. It's amazing.
Well, because he's got nothing to lose, because Legree's like, I've got power over you. And he goes, no, because I can die. And when I die, I'm free. You know, because he was, you know, had already been beaten horribly and everything anyway. So it's not like he was standing there hale and hearty. I just noticed something when I was looking back for a significant quote to me from St. Clair. I'd forgotten his name was Augustine. So think of St. Augustine, who dithered and dithered and looked everywhere for the truth and talked about it a lot and said, Lord, give me chastity, but not yet. And, you know, in the end, he comes around.
I should have caught that.
And so then St. Clair, when he's killed in the bar fight, it's because he just happens to be there. It's not because he's involved in the fight. And he, earlier that day, has had an epiphany. He said he's felt like he's felt thought of his mother so much. I'm like, oh, that can't be good, you know, who he, you know, idolized with good reason. And then when he was, Uncle Tom asked him to read to him from the Bible, and he was reading about, you know, it was the bit about I'll divide you into the sheep and the goats when the end of time comes, and the ones who said, who gave me a cup of water or fed me or visited me in prison, you'll go to heaven, and the ones who didn't won't. And they say, well, when did we ever see you, you know, thirsty or in prison? And he says, well, when you did it to the least of me. And that hits him. And he acts abstracted all day. And so he says, he's talking to Miss Ophelia, and he says, he's talking about how he was struck with it. And he says, one should have expected some terrible enormities charged to those who are excluded from heaven as the reason. But no, they are condemned for not doing positive good, as if that included every possible harm. Perhaps, said Miss Ophelia, it is impossible for a person who does no good not to do harm. And what, said St. Clair, speaking abstractedly but with deep feeling, what shall be said of one whose own heart, whose education and the wants of society have called in vain to some noble purpose, who has floated on, a dreamy, neutral spectator of the struggles, agonies, and wrongs of man when he should have been a worker? I should say, said Miss Ophelia, that he ought to repent and begin now. Always practical and to the point, said St. Clair. But you can see right then, he basically talks about he's resolved to change his life.
Yeah.
And that's when he's like, Tom, I'm going to get the paperwork done. It's going to all be handled. I'm just going to go out and read the paper. And you're just like, no.
And he goes out and he reads the paper and never gets that paperwork done.
No. Well, and the thing, and poor Tom's left going, oh, I can see my wife and my kids again. Well, and the thing is we've had the example again. We had the example with Miss Ophelia earlier when she said, you said you're going to give me Topsy, fill out the paperwork right now.
Uh-huh.
And he says, I thought you wouldn't own slaves. And she says, I'm going to take her north with me and set her free and teach her how to be a real person. And he goes, well, why do we have to do it now? And she goes, because now is all the time we have. And you hear that through the book a lot, too. Don't put it off. Now is when we're here to do something.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. I guess you do see that. Yeah, one of the other things that you see is the power of motherhood.
Oh, my gosh.
Because, you know, Miss Ophelia is an example of that. Mm-hmm. As, you know, as she takes this kid under her wing. And then that... woman that takes the child over the ice that you mentioned?
Eliza.
Yeah, Eliza, right?
Well, and you have Mrs. Bird, who's the senator's wife.
Oh, yeah. We forgot about her. That was an interesting passage there, too.
I love the senator so much. He's
the senator had just voted that, you know, you aren't allowed to harbor any slaves in your house.
In the
north. Even though that the slaves are free there, you aren't allowed to harbor any fugitives, right?
Yeah.
And then one shows up at his door.
His wife had been giving him a hard, in her sweet little way, giving him a hard time about it.
Right.
And it's like, I just don't think that's right. And he's like, well, honey, you just don't understand these things. And she goes, well, I have a mother's heart and I know, blah, blah, blah. And then, like you said, Eliza shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And how does he act?
Yeah. Let her in.
Yeah.
Yep.
Before you know it, he's like, I know we didn't want to. And they just had a child that had died fairly recently. It was about the same age as the little Eliza's little boy. And he's going, okay, I know it's a little soon, but maybe some of, you know, our little boy's clothes would fit him. I mean, he's doing everything. Driving in the middle of the night through a terrible road. Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
Because it's that, you know, I think that's the main thing that Stowe does. It's what you said. It's she makes it personal. It's person to person. And when it's person to person, people change.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
They see the examples in front of them. I mean, it might take a while, like it did with St. Clair.
Mm-hmm. It sinks in. You can feel it if you're into the book. You know, you can feel that pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know it's nothing. Don't get me wrong, folks. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm... You get just a little bit. So a little bit of understanding. I can't claim to fully understand.
Well, no. And nobody can. But that was what she was trying to do with the book. That's
and she
why
did,
she wrote,
did it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why success. She used real examples and talked to real people. And why she kept saying... because she'd had 7 children. And one of them had died young. And she said in her a diary or a letter that when that happened, she suddenly understood in her heart how a slave mother would feel having her child wrested away from her, knowing she would never see that child again. And she goes, and of course, even worse, because you don't know what's going to be done to your child.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when your child dies, at least you have some solace in the idea that, well, I've gone to heaven. But that's why she was doing her best in this book. And maybe that's why people today will still criticize it, kind of for that reason where you said, don't get me wrong. And I was thinking, what? And went, oh, yeah, we can't understand that slave experience.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what that was the point of the book, was to show us over and over. She kept saying, these are people. These are not things. The original name of the book or subtitle was The Man Who Was a Thing.
Oh.
Yeah. And so she was trying to show over and over as much as you possibly could, they are not things. They're not property. They're not articles. They're not legal something or other. These are human beings. And that's why we got all the visions on the slave auction of, you know, the poor old mother with her, you know, 12 or 14-year-old son who they're clinging together. And she's like, Master said he'd leave me one. He took all the others, but he said he'd leave me one. And you're just thinking, oh, my gosh, what this poor woman has been through.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and please buy me two so I can stay with this person. And they're
work really hard.
I don't have the money for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one person who actually bought either her or a different example of that was actually trying to bid for this son.
Right.
But couldn't afford it.
Yeah, it got too high and that was it.
Yeah. And the people who could afford the son were like, she's all old and stringy.
Mm-hmm.
She can't work hard enough.
Oh, it's brutal. You know? Yeah.
Really well, brutal. It is. How much heartbreak. And that's, you can see why Cassie is more than a little crazy. When she tells her story finally, you're just broken down. You know?
Yeah, no question.
But... And of course, us talking like this makes it sound like it's super serious and it's super everything. And it's not, you know, a laugh riot, but it wouldn't be such a popular book and have sold as well if it didn't also have lighter moments, human moments that we could relate to that are not just in gloom the whole time. And it's just, you know, watching what's going to happen next, you just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
for all these people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like reading Dickens, you know, it's the same way. You
talk about serious things. That's how I felt when I was reading it. That's how I felt when I was reading it. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's kind of like Dickens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It talks about the serious themes, but he doesn't do it without the lighter moments, without, because that's what life is. It's all those things.
Right, right. Yeah.
Anyway.
So the subtitle she went with was Life Among the Lowly.
Yeah.
Or the editor went with, whoever went with.
Yeah,
wonder probably where that decision was.
Or it came out, yeah, it came out whenever, you know, in, what's it, episodes, chapters, or whatever, the same way Dickens stuff
did. Yeah, this was a abolitionist serial, right.
Newspaper.
Came out in a magazine called The National Era, right?
Okay.
I'm just looking at Wikipedia. That's interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
It was an abolitionist newspaper. It ran from 1847 to 1860.
Right.
Yeah. So what do you think of the possibly apocryphal meeting with Abraham Lincoln when he's told her, so this is the little lady who started this great war?
I'd like to think it happened. But, you know, the thing is somebody pointed out that whether that happened or not, this is probably the world's most powerful political novel. Yeah. So, in essence, whether he said it or not, the reason we believe it is because it really is true.
Yeah.
It polarized people.
Lots of people read it and reacted to it.
Yeah. And when you think about the fact that if 300,000 copies were sold in this country, that doesn't count how many people heard it while it was being read out loud to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and there was a story, and I can't find it. It must have been in here. Or I also have an annotated version, so it might be in there. But it's like Horace Greeley. Maybe I told you this already before, but Horace Greeley was reading it. And he had to get off the train. He was going back across the country. He was crying so hard over parts of it that he had to just stop and spend the night in a hotel. Couldn't take the travel. Plus that, it was just killing him, man.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, think if somebody wrote a book like that now about something that's happening now.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's lots of them, right? It's just that there's so, I don't know. Maybe they're not as effective or what.
They're not masterpieces.
They're not masterpieces. Plus, they're in an ocean of text.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, it's hard to get books out there.
Well, that's true. Mm-hmm. But there were tons of magazines and newspapers at the time.
Yep, sure enough.
And that's what this came out in.
Yeah.
You know, it was the new media, essentially, then.
So I wonder why Aunt Phyllis's Cabin, Southern Life as It Is, wasn't a big hit.
Harriet Beecher Stowe didn't write it.
In response to Uncle Tom's Cabin, I can't tell who wrote it. Mary Eastman is an example of anti-Tom literature. It says, yeah, among the most famous anti-Tom books are The Sword and the Distaff by William Gilmore Sims, Aunt Phyllis's Cabin by Mary Henderson Eastman, and The Planter's Northern Bride by Carolyn Lee Hentz.
Are these, I guess these are all pictures of idyllic life.
I guess. Says the last author was a close personal friend of Stowe's when the two lived in Cincinnati.
Oops.
Interesting.
Huh. Well, I'm thinking, because, you know, Stowe actually seemed to me to be pretty fair about that. She gave us the Shelbys.
Mm-hmm.
The Shelbys were the nice example. But what she basically was showing is if you're not letting people have their autonomy, they can't control their destiny.
Yeah, and the St. Clairs were the same. You know, they were decent.
Yeah.
Right? They were slave owners, but they were decent. You know, and then, you know, she's just giving an example. Well, it doesn't matter if you're decent. These are slaves, and look what could happen.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, your intentions are your intentions, but now is what you now is when you do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. I guess now you would have a movie or something, maybe.
Yeah, I think that would be more likely nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Although, once Uncle Tom's Cabin came out, it was made into a lot of different variations of plays, which is where, as I mentioned before, the problem came in with the now commonly understood stereotype of Uncle Tom, because that's how he was portrayed in a lot of those.
Yeah.
you know, and this book is so powerful. You read it, and I think I might have mentioned this before, too, is on 30 Rock, you know, you've got Topher, the real nerdy, like, Harvard graduate black guy working for the station, and then you have Tracy Morgan. Uh-huh. And he calls somebody an Uncle Tom, and Topher says, no one should say that who hasn't read the novel. No one's allowed to say that who hasn't read the novel.
That's funny.
I know. I always feel like that.
Wow. Well, this was a good experience.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah,
very good experience having read this.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I've even got a hard copy here.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I know how. That's a great tribute.
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I did want to mention. This just cracked me up.
Go ahead.
Okay. Did you catch when Cassie, who's crazy, I think we can all agree, in a fairly nice way towards most people, when she's hiding in the attic, Cassie's the mad woman in the attic,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like in Jane Eyre.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I didn't make the Jane Eyre connection, but I knew it was her, yeah.
It cracked me up. The first time I read that, I went, oh, my gosh.
When was Jane Eyre?
Jane Eyre.
I forgot about that. When Jane Eyre was before this?
I think so.
That's cool.
Surely had to have been. Now we're going to have to look it up. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now. I love that. I love those connections. 1847.
Yep.
Barely. So it was like being read, you know, pretty popular right then. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so just before, like 4 years.
Oh, okay.
1847 versus 1852. So 5 years.
Yeah, I just kind of felt like that was a little tongue-in-cheek homage kind of thing.
That's right.
Especially if it was popular, which I didn't stop to think about, you know, the timing on it. So that's good that you looked that up. But
that is neat.
Yeah, and the way that she terrorized Legree, you just had to love it. She just played on his superstition.
Yeah.
Which I thought
it was funny that he was superstitious.
Well, and she makes, Stowe said, people who aren't Christian, who aren't religious, are superstitious. And I thought about that and went, oh my gosh. Essentially, that is the case a lot of the time because they put their faith in something else altogether. Not always, but you know,
interesting.
You know, those are the people who are, you know, not eating gluten even though they could, or I don't know, on the paleo diet, or doing other odd things like that because they're putting their faith in those things instead.
All right.
The other thing I was surprised at once I realized how Christian the basis for the book was, is how many people weren't religious. In the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was a fair representation of, you know, we tend to think of it, oh, everybody was Christian. Well, it was, some people were really Christian. Some people said they were Christian. Other people just went, I don't really go for all that.
Yeah.
You didn't expect that.
Yeah. I that didn't leap out at me. But yeah, you're right.
You haven't read it four times, so, you know.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Yeah, I liked St. Clair.
We all liked St. Clair. St. Clair had a tough time.
Yeah. Augustine. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, that's a neat connection. And the Jane Eyre, too. That's neat, too.
Yeah, those are just, I think, considering that she was highly trained in all that stuff, you figure she had to put that in anyway just for anybody who would recognize it. Mm-hmm.
Cool. So. All right. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this?
Man, I don't think I can say anything else about it. It's just, you know, it's such a great book.
Yeah,
don't let the classic label keep you away from it.
Agreed.
Good.
Well, good. Yeah. So let's see. So next up is a movie. Ben-Hur.
Oh, yeah.
There's going to be chariots.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Right. There will be chariots.
That's right. And then after that, we're going to read a piece of nonfiction called Endurance, Shackleton's Incredible Voyage by Alfred Lansing. Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very cold.
Yes, yeah. I don't know how I feel about it, but I think I read this a long time ago.
Oh, good. It's not very long. It's not very
long. No, but I'm looking forward to rereading it.
Oh, good. So, good. Yeah. Good, good, good. And then should I keep going? Because we picked three more. I mean, we're all the way out there. So after that, we're going to do Les Mis. Les Miserables, the 2012 movie.
Yeah.
Yep. So that'll be fun to talk about. Yeah, lots of religion in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's October, and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson, which I have not read, so I'm excited.
Do you like Robert Louis Stevenson?
The only Stevenson that I've read was Abridged, I think. You know, one of those when I was a kid, you know, you have those classics. That
Illustrated classics.
Exactly, yeah. So I read Treasure Island that way. So I don't know that I've officially read Robert Louis Stevenson or not.
You know, and I haven't delved deeply into him, but I love him.
Oh, cool.
I guess I should read more of him since I love him. But
yep. So this was published in 1886. I would just look that up because I was curious. We're hanging out in the 1800s. It's neat.
Sorry, I guess that's me.
That's all right. And then after that, the movie that started it all, Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween.
Yeah.
I love it. That's cool.
Can't wait.
Very, very good movie.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
You bet. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you liked it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, I think it was almost as long as the book.
We did very well. What are you talking about?
Oh, okay. Good.
All right. Well, take care, everybody.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.